Welcome, everyone, to episode 441 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we are taking a brief break from the NBA finals because the NBA draft is coming up. It is 3 weeks from today, and joining us, we have a great guest to go through all of the top prospects. Before we get to that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And joining me today, I have to have a more somber tone when I'm introducing him and with regard to football. Morten Jensen, I'm sorry, man. That was rough.
Yeah. That was not a penalty. Kasper Schmeichel got a laser pointed in his eyes. There were two balls on the pitch at the same time. Absolute atrocity. I mean, I'm not saying that England didn't play well. They really did. But that should have been 1-1 after the extended time. It should have gone into penalties. This was not the way that Denmark should have gone out. I am very disappointed.
Well, on the bright side, there was a lot of NBA action to look forward to. Between the finals, we've got the draft at 3 weeks, free agency. So joining us today to preview the draft is one of our favorites, Jonathan Wasserman, draft analyst at Bleach Report. Wes, how's it going, my man?
It's going well, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, always. Before we get into the draft class itself, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and any work that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, Twitter is NBA Draft Wass. Put out a two-round mock draft yesterday that comes after being in Chicago for about a week, covering the combine and talking with a lot of guys around the NBA. And so there was definitely some movement in the mock that we put out yesterday.
Nice. Yeah, please give Wass a follow. And, you know, worked with him for years. I can vouch, one of the best NBA draft guys out there. So, Wes, let's start at the top, because I think, you know, the Pistons win the number one overall pick, but there's been some scuttlebutt that they're not totally sold on Cade Cunningham with that number one spot. So what do you think they do at number one? And do you think Cade should be the no-brainer pick there, regardless of whether Detroit's the one who actually makes that selection?
So, you know, I've had Cade number one for like 3 years now. Of course, every year, you know, the team that wins the lottery says they're going to do their research and they're going to bring in a lot of guys, and you know, no decision has been made. When I was in Chicago, some of the rival teams had said that word was that Troy Weaver really liked Jalen Green, was the name that came up. I also heard recently from a source that Weaver had already initially told his staff that they were going to go with Cade. And so you hear a lot of things. Obviously, none of it's coming from Detroit specifically, so it's just rumors, and they blow up here and there. But I think they wind up going with Cade. You know, there's going to be a phase where it's Green, and there's going to be a phase where it's Mobley, and it'll all circle back to Cade. And yes, I think he's the right pick at number one. Would I be shocked if in 5 years Evan Mobley was the best player from the class? It wouldn't be the craziest thing in the world, but I think right now, based on everything we know, based on risk-reward, Cade makes sense both in terms of long-term potential and the fit for this Detroit Pistons lineup.
So you said you've had him at number one for like 3 years now. What has made him, you know, stand out in this class?
Yeah, I mean, first you look at a guy his size. I mean, his body and his skill set and his feel for the game all remind you of Luka. And I'm not saying he's going to be the next Luka, but that's the type of player you're getting in terms of a 6'8", 220-pound ball handler who is an excellent passer, and the numbers don't do it justice. At 3.5 assists this year, you know, look past that because he had to score so much. He's easily a guy who could have averaged 6 assists a game if he wanted to and if guys made shots around him. But I think he was even more impressive and better than advertised as a scorer in terms of creating his own shot, shooting 40% from downtown. And so he's just really the full package in terms of that big jumbo playmaker who can, you know, set the table for everyone else, but also take over games when he needs to, with the ability to get his shot from pretty much everywhere on the floor, from the mid-range to the post, from downtown. So it's tough to pinpoint any real worrisome hole in his game.
Yeah. And so what I think you and I recorded right after the lottery, and we were talking, you know, is Cade like so good that you disregard fit. Like, the Pistons spent the number 7 overall pick last year on Killian Hayes, and like, should they go with a wing or a big because of that? How do you see Cade fitting with Killian in particular, but also Jeremy Grant, who I think, you know, is one of their best, or is their best player by far, but, you know, one of their big building blocks moving forward?
Yeah, I think Cade's perfect. Oh, sorry, Mark, go.
No, go. It's all good. I would rather hear your take on that, because I've shared that before.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking in my head, I just, you know, I've heard the criticism, or not criticism, the hesitation about Killian Hayes being there, and they just used a 7 pick on him, but he didn't really show enough to have any real confidence as a rookie that he's going to be a guy who can carry a full workload as a point guard anyway. And so I think even if Killian Hayes stays there and he turns out to be a good player, he could still use another creator in that lineup. And Jeremy Grant's usage was just like so high compared to what it normally is. And so they could just use another guy to create shots to take pressure off both of those guys. And maybe we find out, you know, next year or after next season that Killian Hayes needs to be moved because it's not going to work. But in a vacuum, Killian's ceiling is far higher. I mean, Cade's ceiling is far higher than Killian's. I don't think Hayes' presence in the lineup and the fact that they use a number 7 pick on him should impact their decision in this upcoming draft.
Do you think it could be one of those scenarios where Hayes' development is actually somewhat accelerated by the presence of Cade, because now you have this big guard who can play make, who can score, who can take so much attention away from him?
Yeah, part of me thinks it'll be good for both of them. You know, we just saw Cade do everything for Oklahoma State, and it led to, honestly, some inefficiency. He shot 46% inside the arc. That's the lowest two-point percentage of any number one overall pick in, like, the last decade. And so I think in some regards, it'll be good for Cade to have another guy who handles the ball a little bit and who's a good passer. And then for Killian, yeah, like, defense is stacked up on Killian is bad news. I mean, he's just not ready for that. And he's not skilled enough at this level to be able to handle that. And so I think it'll be good for Killian to have another guy to take pressure off him. And so, yeah, I think it'll actually, there's a good chance it could be good for both of them.
So last Pistons question before we move on, because there shouldn't be this much conjecture about the number one pick. But, you know, if all of this scuttlebutt proves true, and if they don't see a ton of separation between Cade and Jalen Green in particular, wouldn't the smart play then just to be to trade down, you know, to the Rockets, who I would assume, you know, are probably higher on Cade than Jalen? But either way, like, if you're not sold that there's that much of a difference, it reminds me of 2017 with the Celtics, where they said, sure, you know, we don't see a ton of difference between Fultz and Tatum. We're happy with either one.
Yeah, I'm sure it's conversations they talked about. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what Houston would offer to move up to number one. Who's number three? I'm blanking out.
Cleveland.
What Cleveland would offer, and how teams value Sexton, you know, in trade deals. Like, there's a lot going on there in terms of moving parts. But, yeah, they're definitely conversations worth having. And I'm sure there are discussions that have happened inside Detroit's front office about what it would take for them to move down.
Okay,
so I actually have one question before we leave the Cade Cunningham Pistons thing, because this fascinates me to no end. you know how Oklahoma City Thunder have like a million draft picks, and they can swing so many deals. I'm looking at this draft in particular as them having maybe the necessary firepower to make a strong play for a Cade Cunningham who could come in and be their franchise player. Is that at all in the cards, you think?
I'm sure they're thinking about it. I mean, they're not going to use all those picks to make draft picks. I mean, they're going to use them to try and make deals. It really also depends on, like, how Detroit really does value Cade. If they think Cade is another Luka, then these conversations are all irrelevant because they're not going to move down, right? If they're unsure if Cade is that good, or if you know, they have any hesitation about him, or they like equally, you know, Green or Mobley or Suggs, then yeah, then these conversations are a little more realistic to have. But it really all depends on how Detroit values Cade. And regardless of what the rumors say, we have no idea what Weaver really thinks about Cade.
Yep. So assuming Detroit stands pat at one, takes Cade, the real suspense starts at two with Houston. It seems like it's going to be down to Jalen Green, Evan Mobley, Jalen Suggs. In that your latest mock, you have Green going number two. So why do you think Green would be a good fit with Houston there?
Well, I mean, he's exactly what they need. They need a lot. I mean, if offensive, defensively, like to talk about needs is silly with a team like that. That's really at phase one of the rebuild. But I think we're seeing in the playoffs, like teams love these Devin Bookers and the Donovan Mitchells. And there's just like very little. And to even see Anthony Edwards come in and score like he did was a good sign. And I think that may have helped the confidence and belief in Jalen Green that he could similarly do that. And then with Mobley, I think there's just like a hint of risk with taking a big guy top three, which doesn't always pan out well, although Ayton looks pretty good. But he's very thin. I mean, he's just so thin. And I think that just is a little bit scary when you know you can get a guy who could probably put in 25 points a game by his second year in the league. And his comfort level, Jalen Green's comfort level in the G League, and I know it's not the NBA, but his comfort level creating his own shot and making shots and scoring from everywhere was just like, boom. I mean, it just, he just looked like a surefire, big-time NBA scorer. And that's just tough to pass on in today's league when shot creation is valued. Guys can go out and get you 25 every single game. I mean, that's just, there's a lot of value tied to that. And I think Mobley is an awesome prospect, but maybe he's a better answer for a team that already has some pieces in place. So he doesn't have to do as much scoring because that's not really going to be his forte early in his career. So I just think there's a little, with Green, there's a lot of safety and plenty of potential reward. Maybe just a hint more risk with Mobley.
Yeah. You actually brought up an interesting point that I meant to ask even before we got into the specific prospects. You know, based on what you've heard throughout the league and like at the combine last week in particular, have the playoffs changed what teams are looking for in the draft, or really like the last couple years? Like, are teams now valuing shot creation over bigs in particular, like looking for more rangy wings who can play multiple positions, especially defensively?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a thing that's going on that people know that that's the type of guard they want. And again, like after the Wiseman thing, like perception wise, you know, teams are just like a little afraid to take a big guy, and you could just get big guys seems like easier. And they're just harder to find guys like Green. And so I think all of that comes into play here and why right now I'd give Green the nod at number two or give him the edge this early.
Yeah. And if they do go with Green, if the Rockets do go with Green at two, how do you see him fitting with Kevin Porter Jr. in particular?
I think they're pretty interchangeable. I mean, you'd probably play Porter at the three. He's stronger. So he'd probably, you want him guarding more of the wing types, and Jalen more of a guard, guarding ball handlers and combos and stuff like that. But I don't see why they can't fit. I mean, there's enough shots to go around in that offense where I'm not too worried about the two of them together. And they're both ISO players, you know, pick and roll scorers. And it'll be interesting to see where Porter's career goes from here. I mean, he was one of the guys I got right in that draft. I had him as a lottery pick. I mean, I may not have got it right. He may, you know, collapse next year and just totally hit the wall mentally. He's been a little bit unpredictable, but in terms of his talent and skill level, like he's a guy who could put up 20 a game. And so if you have two of those wings on the floor at the same time, I think that's a real plus in today's league.
As for Green, I mean, I had all over at my day job, we interviewed Kevin Tiller, who's the former director of operations for the Ignite. So he was very close to Jalen Green. And one of the things that he said was just the effortlessness in his athleticism as well. He was just popping off the floor. And a lot of people usually just limit athleticism, and nowadays at least just talking about defensive upside. But having someone who can just get from point A to point B in a flash offensively just gives you such a tremendous offensive boost as well. I could definitely see him being very much attractive to teams higher up. I know a lot of people are saying he should be down in like the 4 or 5 range. I would almost be shocked if Green goes that low.
Yeah, I again, just going back to like, he's not going past three. Like the scouts see a star. And I think if there's one question mark is, okay, the offense is going to run through him and his shot selection is a little questionable. If you're questioning him, it's the same questions that were talked about Anthony Edwards. Can an offense run efficiently if it's through his style of shot selection, which is a lot of hero jumpers. But honestly, I think that he's good enough in terms of making those jumpers where it's, not so concerning. You know, it's like the same thing with Zach. Like, we still don't know, is Zach LaVine good? Like, Zach LaVine scores 25 a game, and we still don't really understand his value. And some guys see an all-star, and some guys see somebody that you don't really want to build with. And so that's part of the conversation with Jalen Green. And, yeah, going back to his athleticism, I mean, it doesn't get any better. And I kind of, the way I picture it and think about it and have talked about it is, like, he can get you 15 a game just without making any basketball plays, just because of his first step. And his last step, he beats rim protection to the rim, and he beats you off the bounce off that first step, and he's just impossible to stay in front of, both in the open floor and in the half court. And his, you know, around the rim, he gets like incredible hang time and adjusting in the air, and he's not the most efficient finisher, but some of the finishes he pulls off are mind-blowing. And so if he just adds some nuance and adds some skill to his game, which he's consistently done since he's been a junior in high school, like, there's no reason why he can't be one of the top few scorers in the league.
Yeah. It feels like he is going to be what J.R. Smith was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, I can't, going back to J.R. in high school, I was a little too young, but he was, but Green has, right, every skill and physical trait you can ask for elite scoring potential.
So let's move down to Cleveland then. Because I think if Green, as you said, if Houston goes with Suggs or Mobley at two, Cleveland, pretty no-brainer, goes Green there. If Green's off the board, and it's probably between Mobley and Suggs. So if you were Cleveland, which one of those guys would you prefer?
I'd go Mobley. I mean, I have Mobley pretty much in a different tier than Suggs. I mean, in a vacuum, I'd take Mobley, and then for that particular team, I'd take Mobley. And obviously, the big question is, what do you do about Jared Allen? And do you resign him, and do they play together? I'm not against the idea of playing Mobley at the four. I mean, I mostly because he can guard that position. And they always say, you know, your position is who you can guard. Mobley can guard fours. The question is, offensively, will he create enough space with Allen, you know, for the guards? And I hesitate on that. You know, I know I think eventually he's going to be a threat from downtown. Right now, I buy his shot in the mid-range. Them two together, Mobley and Allen, is not ideal. But I think when you head into the draft, you worry about what you're going to do with Allen later, and you take the best player available. Mm-hmm. And Mobley, to me, is the best player available. And, you know, if you have to let Allen walk and save some money there and let Mobley thrive as your anchor, you do it. I think he's that good of a prospect, and he's that good of a fit for the other cornerstones for what they have. You know, with Suggs, like, if you take Suggs, you have to know that you can get a deal for Sexton that you really like. Mm-hmm. You can't really play them all three together, and to waste a number three pick on the guy you're going to bring off the bench just doesn't really make that much sense. So you have to know that hopefully Cleveland has done their homework on what type of return they can get for Sexton, assuming he's the guy that they would deal over Garland, although I could be totally wrong there. But yeah, regardless, you have to know that there's some type of deal in place that you like before you draft Suggs, I would think. Because Sexton's another guy, like LaVine, like, his value is all over the place. Like, is he good, mm-hmm. or is he not the guy you want to build with? And I don't really know the answer to that question. Really, what I think doesn't matter. It's what teams who are in the trade market think about their value. So hopefully Cleveland has done their homework to get a feel for what the value is of those two guards. So they know whether or not it's worth taking a guy like Suggs.
Yeah. You know, my thought with Cleveland in particular, if you take Mobley and you were planning on re-signing Allen, and then you get this lucky break and all of a sudden you have another big, it gives them some leverage in those contract negotiations. Whereas, you know, if Allen comes in wanting a max deal, I don't think you want to sign Jared Allen to a max deal, but you might have felt pressure to do so before Mobley fell into your lap. So now you say, okay, now we have a price point that if you get more than that, we'll just let you walk. Like, we didn't give up that much to get you, so it's not a huge loss.
That's true.
Whereas I think you're right, with Suggs, it's like you're almost forced to trade Sexton in particular. I mean, have you heard, it sounds like they're lukewarm on what Sexton is going to want on this next contract. So have you heard a lot in terms of his availability and like what they're looking for in return?
I haven't heard anything specific on him, but knowing Sexton, like from high school, like he's going to want the bag. He's got like an unbelievable amount of confidence in himself, and he's going to want a lot of money. So he's so tricky because I just don't really know what other teams think of him. Mm-hmm. And really how Cleveland values him to this particular team. I mean, you look at his numbers and they're awfully good. I mean, we think of him as like this inefficient guy, but I think he shot like 48% from the floor and put in 25 a game. And so I don't know. He's just tough to really to get a feel for what his value is and how Cleveland values him. And what other teams would pay for him. It's tough.
I only ask because he continually comes up in the trade Ben Simmons discussion. It's like Sexton and Love has been the other package that you hear all the time other than CJ McCollum. So, I'm curious in terms of like what Cleveland is hoping to get in return for him and what they would be willing to get, you know, especially if they're trying to package Love with him, what type of return they're hoping to get there.
Right. And then there's the other question, like what happens if Cleveland thinks that Suggs is the best player in the draft?
Right.
I mean, and then if they think Suggs is definitely better than Mobley, which is possible, I don't think that's the craziest thing in the world. Then they'll have a little more motivation to give up Sexton and may not need like a ridiculous haul in return.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to Toronto now, because it feels like if the board breaks in this way, Toronto might be the big winner of the draft here just by getting, you know, you go into the draft lottery thinking you're probably going to be in like the 7-8 range. You jump up to 4. Kyle Lowry's about to be a free agent and like, oh, here's Jalen Suggs who just falls right into your lap. So what do you think about Suggs' fit in Toronto? How could he play next to Fred VanVleet in particular? And do you think if the board falls in this way and, you know, they do get Suggs, is Kyle Lowry looking for a new home this summer?
I mean, the NBA guys, you know, you guys cover the NBA, so you would probably have a better idea than me of what they're thinking with Kyle Lowry. And I'm sure that they've already thought this through, knowing where they're picking on the board and who's likely to go top three, and they're going to, you know, how do they value this whole bring in Suggs versus move Lowry? And I mean, you can tell me, like, do you think Lowry, are they going to try and compete again next year with the same group? I mean, it doesn't really make much sense. They won 27 games. I think clearly their ceiling is capped at this point. And so it would, from my perspective, it would make sense to just move on from Lowry and grab Suggs, who I think just really replaces him so easily. They're almost similar players. And so I think it's an easy plug and play fit with Suggs and VanVleet. But again, Lowry is so much attachment to that city, and I don't know how they value that situation with him. And so I don't know, what do you guys think? Do you think that Toronto is ready to reset a little bit, or is Lowry such a big part of that franchise that they're going to want to bring him back?
Oh, we've had this conversation a lot, and it's honestly a very interesting situation they're in, specifically this summer, because they could go all in on a rebuild if they wanted to and move off of Siakam and Fred VanVleet and just get a ton of draft picks and complement that with the number 4 pick or whoever drops to that point. Or they could sort of retool a little bit, get Jalen Suggs and keep Fred VanVleet around, keep the Siakam around, and see what they can do with this young group that some of them are prime guys, some of them are younger, like Gary Trent Jr. I think is only 22 still, so there's time there. OG Anunoby, 23 or 24. So like they can just swing in whatever position they want. I think personally, it's one of the biggest question marks in the entire NBA. Like they can change their future so easily this summer. It just depends on what they do. And also, like, just the uncertainty of not knowing whether Masai Ujiri is going to be there. It is like, just there's so many question marks hovering around this team. But I personally think they need to explore every single avenue. I mean, we know the Knicks can absorb Fred VanVleet's contract immediately. They're looking for a point guard. They could hand over several draft picks. They have 2 in the first round this year. They could attach future picks down the line. You know, you can definitely get off of Pascal Siakam. That there's probably a case to be made that he could go to the Golden State Warriors in a trade where James Wiseman comes back and like the Minnesota pick. Like there's so many possibilities with that team. but you like you said something that's also interesting, just in terms of the entire attachment, the emotional attachment to Kyle Lowry and the Raptors. I think it really boils down to what he wants to do. If he's like, I want to get back there. I love Toronto. I want to be a part of this thing one more time. Then I think all their plans of a retool or a rebuild, that goes out the window. It's like, let's get Kyle back. Let's see what we can get. And then it doesn't even matter how many wins we squeeze out.
Yeah. Yeah. Toronto's in a weird spot. I mean, you look at that roster and they have like good young players. And some veteran guy, and you think they'd have won more games. And I'm not a Raptors guy. I don't watch all those games. I don't really understand why they didn't win as many games. I guess injuries played some role in it. But they're in a weird spot where they have good young players. You think that their ceiling is higher than what the record showed. But at the same time, there's an opportunity to like restart. We're talking about trading Siakam. Like, he was the man 2 years ago, like an up-and-coming like all-star player. And now we're talking about trading him. And Van Vliet, they just signed him to this big deal, and he's another up-and-coming guy. And OG is like better offensively than I thought he would be. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about blowing this up. I mean, it's like they just started with these young guys, and here they are with the fourth pick. I mean, there's just so many different directions they can go with this. So yeah, this is definitely one of the more interesting situations to monitor.
Yeah.
Regardless, I don't think they can fail. Like Brian, you basically said this by getting the fourth pick, they're getting like one of the top. We mostly consider this draft like there's a clear top four, and then there's a significant step down from there. So just for them to secure one of those, huge, absolutely huge.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think that's what like they almost can't go wrong. Like if Mobley falls to them at four, and you can pair Siakam and Mobley in the front court, that works. If Jalen Green somehow falls to four, Fred VanVleet and Jalen Green is a great combo. Like, no matter what, as long as they get one of those guys, which they now will, they're in great shape. But, you know, I'm less in the, like, total blow-it-up rebuild. I think they've got, as you said, Wes, they have some, like, good, you know, Siakam and VanVleet are both 27 now. So, like, they're a little older than we would think for, like, up-and-coming guys. But guys who are still growing into their roles. But then, you know, OG is turning 24 in a couple weeks here. Who else? Oh, Gary Trent Jr. You know, they're presumably going to re-sign him. He's only 22. You get Malachi Flynn, who at least could show some flashes off the bench. You add Jalen Suggs to that. Like, Suggs, Van Vliet, Gary Trent, OG, Pascal lineup is pretty much exactly what you would think out of a modern NBA small ball lineup. Like, that thing is going to cook both offensively and defensively. So, you know, I for their sake, I hope they get Suggs at four. Let Lowry. I think ideally you would work out a sign and trade for him if you're, you know, trying not to lose him for nothing. But I just had a piece published at FanSided like minutes ago about this, where if he walks, they actually have about like an extra $10 million in cap space plus the room mid-level. So they have more room to build out their bench, which, you know, big was a big issue for them last year until they got Ken Burch at the end of the season. So I think there's a lot of reason to move on from Lowry now, depending on how the draft shakes out. But they are in, you know, I think they're going right back into playoff contention next year if they don't take a sledgehammer to this thing.
Another hypothetical to think about that I was just, I think Mobley would be great for Toronto. And I don't think he's going to be there at four. And I know that there are people in the Rockets organization that really like Suggs. You wonder if there's like a 2-4 swap.
Oh,
that could happen. If Toronto obviously has the pieces to make an interesting trade up. And depending on, again, this is all on how Houston values the Mobley, Green, Suggs, 1-2-3. Those are two teams you'd think should have some type of conversation.
Yeah. That is interesting.
It is. Like, Houston needs everything, like we already talked about. So for them to pick up additional assets that
right,
way.
Like, right. If they don't see a big difference between Mobley, Green, and Suggs, and again, I know people in their organization who really like Suggs. If they were to move down to four and get something really big in return, and if you're Toronto, I mean, I think Mobley is just so perfect there. That's something to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So it seems like there's a pretty clear top four at this point. Earlier in the year, it seemed like Kuminga was in there as a top five, but now there seems to be a little bit more separation between him and these top four guys. So let's move to number five, the Orlando Magic, the first of two lottery picks for them. You have Kuminga going there in your most recent mock. So how do you see him fitting with the Magic?
Yeah, I mean, he gives them something they don't have, which is like a front court score. And I love Isaac, and I'm high on Chuma Okeke, but Kuminga is like a go-to guy in an offense. And they don't really have that up front, unless I'm forgetting somebody. But, I mean, he was before the G League, he was a guy who people thought could be a potential number one overall candidate. He played a couple games. People still thought that. In fact, I think they thought it more after a couple games. And then he fell off. His shot stopped falling. And you see, he takes some tough shots, and the ball sticks to his hands a little bit too much. And he doesn't really offer a lot of ancillary skills. You know, like, he's like a scorer. And if he's not scoring, you know, what's he doing? I think that's the big knock on him. However, he's 6'8", 220, athletic, powerful, fast. And he can get his own shot from everywhere on the floor. And despite the poor shooting numbers, he's a shot maker. And they say he's 18 years old. I know some people question that. But assuming that's the case, there's enough shot making skill in his bag that I think he could eventually improve as a shooter. He blew people away during his pro day, although everyone seems to do that. And so, I mean, to me, for Orlando, like, he's a scorer that you can put at 3 or 4 who you can feature in the half court. And I just don't think you can really say that about Isaac and Okeke. And so I think he makes sense for them on paper. And then there's Scotty Barnes, who is like really trending right now in the draft conversation. To me, he's not the greatest fit because that group needs some offense. And I love Isaac there as their defensive specialist. And I just don't know if they get enough offense if you throw Barnes into that group. I'm also a believer in best player available, and you figure it out from there. But I think at this point, I'd still give the edge to Kuminga. I don't think Barnes is like clear cut much better.
Gotcha. Do you think, given where Orlando is in their team building process, you know, they have 5 and 8, so they could, in theory, try to combine those picks and move up. Do you think they should try it? Like, would a Suggs, Mobley, Green be worth trading both of those picks? Or, you know, should they just take swings on two guys in this range instead?
I hate this. I hate this range in like every draft. Like the 6 to 10, the 6 to 10 range is like, I'm not a fan of that range, particularly in this draft. And not that I don't like those guys, but the guys who are projected to go there, I just don't have this, like, near the same level of confidence as I do in the top four guys. And so absolutely, if I'm Orlando, I don't need two more young guys. And I do like the idea of, like, they're like two gambles that could potentially pay off. You know, it's two swings instead of one. Mm-hmm. But I think in this draft, there are four sure things. Like, I can't see any way that those top four guys aren't going to be good pros. And so, and not just good pros, but like valuable cornerstone pros. And in the 6 to 10 range, you know, I don't have a ton of confidence in Davion Mitchell. Keon Johnson from Tennessee is in that range that they're going to be looking at, right? Kuminga, Barnes, James Booknight, like, these are good prospects, but my level of confidence drops a lot. Based on guys with top 10, you think the value would just be higher. If I'm Orlando, I'm trying to move 5 and 8. I'm trying to move up to get Mobley. Would be my target. Or Green, and then Suggs right behind it. But yeah, that would be my move to try and package and move up into the top four.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, part of me was thinking positionally based on who they have. You know, backcourt, you already have Markel and Cole Anthony. In the front court, you just traded for Wendell. You have Mobamba still. Like, with the top four being so guard and big heavy, maybe they're happy staying here because you probably do get swings at two forwards or two wings instead. But as you said, if they don't have confidence in these guys panning out, like, I feel like this has been the problem for Orlando really for most of the past decade. Like, every time they have a high pick, they just get it in the wrong draft class, or, you know, they haven't maximized these guys either.
Orlando needs we look at the guys that we're talking about in Orlando, mm-hmm. and we don't really know where their careers are going. I mean, there's a good young prospects, but like, who's RJ Hampton going to be? Who's Cole Anthony going to be? Markel Fultz, totally unpredictable. Wendell Carter, I mean, even Okeke, like, we don't know how, none of them are like surefire stars. They have a lot of good, promising young prospects, and maybe one of them blows up. But we just, there's the level of, you can't have any real confidence in any of these guys or star players. I think you can have a lot more confidence that Cade or Suggs or Green or Mobley is going to be a star player. And I think all of those guys are better prospects than anyone Orlando has on their roster right now.
Yeah, I would go Green. I would try my damnedest to trade up for Jalen Green if I'm Orlando, because they have pivoted towards defense so many times in the past, and you just see that it's just not working out. In today's NBA, you need explosive offense. I understand that they had Vooch and all that, but he's someone who has to be reliant upon guard play. Like, you need a guard who can self-create. And then I know Magic fans are going to come at me and say, well, Cole Anthony did that to a certain extent. And yes, he did, but he is not a Jalen Green. Jalen Green will come in right off the bat on that Orlando team if they find a way to acquire him and probably get 20, like, every single game. He's that good. I think that's the guy they need to target, if anything.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense.
Okay, so let's slide down to OKC at number 6. I know a lot of people on draft lottery night were saying they were one of the biggest losers because they didn't get the Houston pick, didn't convey, and then they also slide down a little bit. They missed that top 4 range, so they're not going to get one of these top guys without trading up. Mm-hmm. You have Scotty Barnes going there. Another defensive guy who can't shoot, so this is right up OKC's alley, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think OKC, I think they won 2 games in the last 2 months of the season. Like, they are at rock bottom. And I don't know how you even think about fit and needs. And you just got to take the best player available here. And Barnes is generating top 5 buzz. And I think the interest typically can be, like, contagious. Like, you see so much love for a guy, the teams start to feel like, oh, maybe we were missing something. And I think Barnes at this point is moving into this as a top 6 lock. And if it's not Barnes, it'll be Kuminga. And then, because also number 7, like, nobody really separates themselves as the next best guy. Booknight, you know, to me, Booknight, like, at 6 just seems like a reach. And Mitchell at 6 is a reach. And you go down the list of the next group of guys, I'm just not in love with this next group. And I think Barnes is the type of guy who can have, you know, I think the term I've been using is, like, outlier star potential, where it's not traditional upside. You know, we think upside, we think guys who can get you 25, we think are big time athletes or elite playmakers. Like, his upside comes in a different form. I mean, he's like another version of Draymond Green, where he's a star but in a different way. And OKC regardless has to just continue building no matter what and continue adding pieces. You know, Barnes is just so unique. You can't really replicate his skill set. You know, guys like him don't come around. 6'9", 227, who can lead your team in assists and guard 5 positions. It's just a unique skill set. And also just a high intangible guy. He blows people away in interviews. Everybody from his high school coaches to his teammates just rave about him. He's just like a very likable player. And I think based on who would be left on the board, he's just going to be the answer.
And I mean, the Thunder are just, you're right, they're like still very much in the early stage of rebuilding, but they have the potential to just put together such weird lineups, especially because of Poku, who, like, I still just cannot figure out. Like, he, you know, it's a guard set or guard skill set and a 7-footer's body. But in theory, like, a Barnes Poku front court down the road seems pretty intriguing, right?
I'm into it. First of all, it's going to be fun as hell to watch. Yeah. Another guy, like, we have no idea what he's going to look like in 3 years. He could be like a fluky fun player, or he could be like a star player. But he's has the more scoring potential, where Barnes is the passer and defender, and the intangible guy. And so I think it's, if Poku hits his stride and becomes the player that OKC thinks he has the potential to be, and so does Barnes, I think it's a match that could work.
What about Sinkin at 6? Because I like him at 6. You can laugh all you want, Brian, but look, I am into this guy. I think there's a lot of potential there. I understand that people are questioning his defense and the slow feet. I get it. but he is just so productive, and there isn't anything that indicates that the shooting won't come around. He's got such a clean stroke from the free throw line. He can pass like nobody's business. I was speaking to a couple pro scouts as well about him. I mean, there were Jokic comparisons, which personally I think were those were a little bit optimistic, of course, so I don't agree with those. But I like the fact that scouts are pointing out the passing. It's something that I don't see a whole lot of people talking about so much. I think this guy is flying under the radar. So what am I missing here, boss?
You're just missing, and you're not missing anything. He could very well be a top five player from this draft. He's one of those guys who's got his range of outcomes is pretty wide. I mean, in today's league, like, post players who can't guard the perimeter or stretch the floor are just not as valued. And that's really what it comes down to. It's just like his style. And maybe in a couple of years, suddenly the flashes that we see of ball handling in the open floor and the nifty passing, like, if those become regular occurrences, and like, you know, I've seen him hit the threes and he's hit step backs. And, I mean, he shot 20% from downtown, but if you're buying the flashes, eventually becoming regular, then he's got a chance to be one of the best players in this draft. But if he's just mostly a post guy and a role guy, an offensive rebounder, then I just think his value is not that high. His chance of hitting upside is not that high. But yeah, of course, he's so young and his production overseas is unprecedented. Pretty much for a guy his age in the Turkish league. And I think he's going to go top 16. I don't think Oklahoma City lets him get past their second pick at 16, the one they got from Boston. No. I'm sure he's going to get looks from Orlando and Sacramento, who could use a center. I've talked to a couple scouts who they've asked me, they said, how high do you think he'd go? I said, I think he'd go to Orlando at 8. And they were shocked. They're like, you really think Chengun could go that high? And I said, yeah, it's just really everyone's opinion is so different, but I could easily see a team saying he's the MVP at 18 years old of the Turkish league. He's just consistently productive. He shot 80% from the free throw line. Over the second half of the season, we saw a lot more passing, a lot more face set moves. I guess, and you know, if you're betting against him, it's like those moves are a little bit slow. Yeah. You know, some of his fluidity really isn't there. Obviously, defending away from the basket where his feet get stuck in the ground and he looks heavy-footed. But offensively, some of his moves are just, you know, takes him a little while to get him off. And then you have to pay attention to who he's blowing by. And some of them are just not like NBA-caliber guys. But that's really, I know I'm talking a lot here, but there's just so many outcomes for him that really will come down to all it takes is one team, right? All it takes is one team to be you, Mort. And maybe it'll be... Maybe it'll be Orlando at 5. Like, you know, it's just unpredictable where he's going to go.
Yeah. Well, we brought you on to talk, so I'm glad to hear it.
Sometimes it takes you a while to get to the point, yeah.
No, but I appreciate it because I still think there is a level of American skepticism about international players still. And I'm not saying you. I'm just saying, generally speaking, it does. I mean, for crying out loud, Lucas still fell to 3 years ago, right? I mean, these things happen. I think if Sengun had put up these numbers in college, I think we would have such a vastly different opinion of him and what he's doing out there. When I watch him play, I understand. I agree with you that his feet are slow. But I also know damn well that when it comes to European prospects, they aren't that accustomed to, you know, getting into the weight room, for example. So I think there could be that body change over the next coming years, like getting into an NBA organization, having him hit the weights a little bit more, slim down, get more toned. That should help on his speed. That should help on his athleticism a little bit. I don't know. There's something there where I'm thinking that if he goes 16, like first and foremost, like the OKC would get a steal at that point, in my opinion. But then I could see a lot of teams going in a couple of years. We should have pulled the trigger. We should have gambled.
Yeah, maybe. And I could totally see him being like another Sabonis, but I'd personally rather let somebody else take the gamble.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mort, you will be happy that Wass does have him going 16 to the Thunder. So he does still go on the Thunder, just not
No, but it's, I'm just bringing it up because I think he is deserving of some attention. So, I mean, I still see people on draft Twitter having outside the first round, which I just, that completely blows my mind. I don't think he's... Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I think he's absolutely destined to get picked in the first.
And so listen, unless you have that confidence that he is going to be a star, I just think right in that range, there are guys who are just like, you know, Keon Johnson, people want athletic wings, and Moses Moody is a 3-and-D wing, like people want them. Josh Giddey is another guy who is going to be right in that conversation. I think a team is going to just be a little bit more intrigued by a 6'10 playmaker than rather gamble. And Franz Wagner, who I think is just like such a perfect fit for today's league. You know, Sengun is just not the fit that everybody desires. And I think they just rather take a chance on a wing or a guard than a big guy who's not really a rim protector, a switch defender, or right now a three-point shooter.
He would be interesting, like, because they traded Moses Brown to OKC, like, if they get him at 16, he would probably slide in and get minutes right off the bats, though. And, like, that could be interesting to see what he could turn into. But I totally hear you. I mean, wings and defensive versatility, that's all the rage nowadays. I think I'm personally leaning towards more offensive players. I guess I think at the end of the day, great offense will always be great defense. And the more you can just squeeze out great offense, I think that needs to be the priority.
Yeah.
Yeah, the board in that mid to late Lotto range also isn't super friendly to Sengun in that, if it holds true and there aren't a ton of trades, because the Magic maybe they gamble, but you know they already have Carter and Bamba there, and you got to sort that out. The Kings definitely need a center. The Hornets need a center. So 9 and 11 are real options. Pelicans have Steven Adams and Jackson Hayes already.
And the Spurs are at 12, and they Lord knows they like their internationals.
Yeah, but they already have Jakob Poeltl. Pacers at 13 have, you know, Sabonis and Turner. They have way too many bigs already. Warriors just spent number 2 on Wiseman. So Wizards even seem pretty happy with Daniel Gafford. So, hey, maybe the Thunder do walk right into a steal at 16 there. Wes, you've mentioned a couple times now that you are lukewarm in that mid to late Lotto range. But who are some of your favorite guys? You know, probably in that like 7 to 15 group.
I like Franz Wagner. I think he's, I don't think everybody sees a potential star, but I think he's one of those like star role players. He reminds me of Nick Batum. I think he's going to be just like Nick Batum, as like a 6'9", 3-and-D wing who can also be a pick and roll facilitator. And, we never think of Nick Batum in his prime. Was like a really valuable player, even if he didn't have the star label or power. But I think if he goes to a right team that can optimize his versatility at both ends, I think he's going to be a steal in this draft, because he's not going top five. He's going to go in that later lottery range. Jalen Johnson is a guy who I've heard, Jalen Johnson was supposed to go top 8 in this draft, and he still could, but he really just didn't help himself this past season, leaving Duke midway, created even more questions, because in high school, he changed high schools a couple times. He got to IMG and was supposedly kicked out. We don't know why. And so I happen to like his talent. I think he's like a top 10 talent, no question. I think he could slip because of some of these personality questions. And sometimes those are overstated, and sometimes they're not. But if he gets his head on straight and he gets the right support system, I think he's going to be a steal in this draft too. 6'9", 220, open floor playmaker, awesome around the basket, rebounder, switch defender. I'm high on him, and I think his shot can be capable enough to complement the rest of his game. And I like Josh Giddey. Like I said before, I think he's I'm told from his camp that he's 6'8" and a half in socks. And so if he's close to 6'9", 6'10", with his ball handling and passing, to me, he's like a big Ricky Rubio is kind of the comparison. And if he goes to the right team where he can also play to his strengths as a facilitator, I think he's going to unlock a lot of guys around him. 18 years old, to lead that league in assists is pretty is pretty impressive. And so Giddy is somebody to me I'm pretty high on.
Oh, I like that comp. I hadn't thought about that. A 6'9 version of Ricky Rubio, that would be insane. I mean, the passing chops, the rebounding ability. If he gets just a little bit more consistency with his three-point shot. So this is actually an interesting thing. I want to ask you about this. So I've watched him play a fair bit as well, and I see a lot of people are knocking like the shot mechanics. I see somewhat of a slow release, sure, but I don't see something that's fundamentally flawed. So what's the criticism about in regards to his shot?
I mean, I don't think he's a great free throw shooter, which raises some concern. I'm not like the craziest shot doctor guy. Like, okay, we've seen guys with wacky mechanics be good shooters. Right. Nothing I see is totally worrisome. And also because of his height advantage, like he can afford to be a little bit slower on that release. Like, I don't know who's going to be guarding him at the next level, but they're certainly not going to be 6'9". And so nothing about his shot worries me. Do I think he's going to be like a 40% shooter? No. But I think really people look at his free throw percentage and wish it was higher. And the volume, you know, he doesn't take a ton of threes. But there was a stretch this season where he got hot and he made a couple a game for like, you know, 2 weeks straight. And so, no, he's never going to be a knockdown shooter. But I think he can threaten defenses enough, again, to complement the rest of his game. And he's not out there to score 20 points, and I wouldn't bet on him ever even approaching that. But I think his value is going to be felt in other ways, as a connector type who just makes the game easier for everyone, gets the offense flowing, easy shots for teammates. A great kid. I mean, he's just so much fun to listen to talk about the game. And so for those reasons, and you know, we're talking about a late lottery pick, you know, so he doesn't, we have to lower the bar in terms of his scoring potential. But again, for the right team that has enough shot makers and scorers around him, no big deal if he's a 35% three-point shooter.
Right. And he's more opportunistic scoring-wise.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I asked the question about the mid to late lotto guys, in part because I'm curious about Golden State in particular. We already talked about Orlando being a potential trade-up candidate with 5-8. Golden State sitting there with 7-14. You know, after the season, they are on record, like to a man, basically saying, we want guys who are ready to win now. Like, it was kind of a shot at Wiseman. Like, they don't want, you know, guys 3 or 4 years down the road, that's when they're going to really start to find their footing, because Steph Curry is still in his prime. Klay Thompson's coming back next year. Draymond Green's at the tail end of his prime. Like, they are very much in a win now window. So are there guys who in that range that you think could just be plug and play right away, ready to help them win? Or do you think they'd be better off trading one or both of those picks for some win now vets?
I'm not a big Corey Kispert guy, but I think if there was a team that that would get the most out of him fast, it's Golden State. I mean, he's extremely mature, 6'7", 220, arguably the best shooter in the draft. And he does it. He's got that quick release, and not just catch and shoot, but like off movement, quick trigger transition stuff. He was also the number one transition player in terms of points per possession in the country. And so he just knows how to capitalize without needing a lot of dribbles. And I think that's kind of perfect for Golden State's lineup.
And he knows to play with great players. I mean, he played on an absolutely stacked Gonzaga team, so it would be a seamless transition.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be an easy transition. He knows his, and just another really smart guy. He knows his, will know his role, and will pick things up fast there. And just if Myers is, you know, not just blowing smoke, and he really does want immediate contributors, Kispert's to me the target at 14. I like Moses Moody as a fit because he's such a good off-ball scorer. Another guy, he was top five in the country, top five freshman in the country in scoring. And only 10% of his possessions combined were pick and roll and isolation. Like, everything was spot up, you know, offensive rebounding, transition, opportunistic stuff. And I think that's kind of what you want in that offense. But it wouldn't be shocking if he needs, you know, a year or two, you know, kind of the way Devin Vassell did. Vassell is kind of the comparison we've used for him as a 3-and-D guy. And he struggled badly in the NCAA tournament. It wouldn't be surprising if he needed a year to get comfortable physically. But that style of play to me fits Golden State.
Yeah, I've seen pretty much everyone, all the fans of people or fans of teams in that range that I follow. Everyone seems to love Moses Moody, so I'm glad you touched on him there. Let's go down a little further. You know, obviously, like, later first round, second round, pretty much a total crapshoot at that point. But who are some guys that stand out to you in that range that you think are going to, you know, wind up being steals, outplaying their draft slot?
I've come around on Cam Thomas from LSU, who it's hard to love his game because he takes so many bad shots, but he's so good at making them. I mean, the list of guys, list of freshmen over the last 15 years to average 23 a game, it's seven of them, and three of them are, you know, Durant and Trae Young and Beasley. It's just the production and the shot-making skill is just tough to argue against. And, you know, I talked to a scout the other day who's like, if he goes to a shitty team, then he's probably going to develop bad habits. But if he goes to a good team where his shot selection would just naturally have to be tighter and he'd have guys around him and less freedom to do some of the wacky things he does, then I think he's got a chance to be a steal. Another guy I like, I mean, I really like Jared Butler. The heart problems are concerning, and I'm no doctor. But if this turns out to be a non-issue and he slips in the draft, I mean, some team is getting a steal in Jared Butler, who is just such an easy fit on and off the ball. We saw him help Baylor win a national title. He's just so good at so many different things that I think he's an easy fit and kind of like a quickly type. Another guy, Miles McBride from West Virginia. He's one of my favorite sleepers in the draft. I don't know if you can call him a sleeper anymore. He's gaining a lot of steam as a potential first rounder, but 6'2", he measured a 6'9 wingspan, really pesky defender, which is what he's always been known for, is his pace and pressure defense. But this year, he really improved his shooting up to 42%. He can get his pull-up anytime he wants, and I think it's just a matter of time before he starts converting it more often. And so, no, maybe he's not a star point guard, but for somebody you take in the 20s, I think he's got the chance to be a very solid role player for a long time. So those guys. And then Sharif Cooper is a guy who I'm also very high on and pretty much give a lottery grade to. Another guy who I think is very team dependent. And I don't know if he's going to go in the lottery, if he's going to go, you know, to the Knicks at 21 or 19 or whatever. But if he goes to the right team where he could just play to his strengths as a playmaker, not have to worry about scoring the way he did at Auburn, which is why he was only 39% from the field. Just put him in a role where his job is to push the pace, create shots for teammates. I think he's the type of guy who could, like, lead the league and assist, you know, at some point. Yeah. I think he's that good off the dribble, seeing things and delivering passes with both hands.
I'm so glad you brought up Sharif, because I was going to ask about him. I think people are really sleeping on this kid. People are looking at the shooting percentages, as you touched on, and they're basically saying, oh, can we really have a guy that's that inefficient? I don't think that was his role. I mean, when you have the court mission that he does and you're forced to drive the ball virtually every single time down, I don't think you maximize your skill set. So I'm super glad you brought some context into that. I'm also really curious about your opinion on Jaden Springer. He seems to be, you know, in favorite on NBA Draft Twitter. What do you see out of him that is just so attractive?
You know, I don't see like crazy upside, but I do see just a very good role-playing, versatile guard. So he kind of reminds me of De'Anthony Melton. That's the type of player I see. Where is he, your lead guard? No. Is he a scoring two guard? No. But he does a lot of the good things, and I think he's very interchangeable and a very tough defender. I've heard guys are dropping out of workouts if they heard that Jaden Springer is there. I mean, he's tough. He's one of the youngest players in the draft. I think there are a lot of questions about his ability to create his own shot and does he have the burst to blow by guys? But it also reminds me of the Tyrese Haliburton situation last year, where we kind of put too much stock into the negatives and didn't really appreciate what he does well. Right. And if you put him as a secondary ball handler, where he doesn't have to make all your lead decisions, but where he could play off another guard, be a complimentary piece, I think he's got the chance to be a very good role player.
Interesting. Yeah, I've I didn't get a chance to watch much of Tennessee this year, so I am genuinely curious. That buzz was is very intense, so I wanted to see if that was something that holds true. And just the fact that you bring up De'Anthony Melton, I mean, that's NBA Draft Twitter's favorite still to this day. So that makes a lot of sense. Finally, of course, I mean, because he is from Europe, as is I, Usman Garuba from Real Madrid. I mean, the defense to me is just mind-blowingly awesome already. I mean, at what, 18, 19 years old, the upside, the defensive upside is virtually unlimited. The offense, however, is far more raw and unsettling. So what kind of role can we expect for him to have moving forward? Is he just basically destined to be a defensive-oriented guy?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, like I talked to a scout the other day, and I was like, what do you think of Garuba? He goes, nothing special. You know, it's just because, like, yeah, everybody likes his defense.
Yeah.
But how much, you know, how do you value in this draft a 6'8 forward who really gives you nothing offensively? And maybe he is going to be a fantastic defender, but, like, he's got to be, like, all-NBA defender if you're going to take him in the lottery. Because it's just tough to see any path to offensive value. And so, to me, I wouldn't take him in the lottery, but if I'm a playoff team who needs to improve defensively, he's on my board. I mean, he's a target for me in that 15 to 30 range. But for the right team, you know, he's a tough guy to value in this draft, and I think everyone is going to value him differently based on their particular roster.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I could definitely see someone wanting to improve their bench defense, for example, where he would be a prime candidate.
Yeah. And he could play. Yeah. He'd play next year. There's no doubt about it. Kind of like Xavier Tillman. Just that's his role, you know, play defense, you know, make enough passing reads, which I think he's a pretty good passer, and finish the plays that come to you in the offense. And that's your job. And anything else is a bonus.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes you watch him shoot a three and it looks like, you know, he could eventually add that, but it's not something you count on right now. Right now, you're just counting on his effort, his defensive IQ to make those rotations and to switch and cause problems around the perimeter. And that's his focus. And anything else is total bonus.
So I have two more guys that I want to hit on. And then one final question for you. So I've seen, you know, assuming the Sixers keep their pick at 28, which is no sure thing at the moment, I've seen Trey Mann and Trey Murphy come up a lot in those discussions. You and your latest mock have those guys well off the board by that point. So sorry in advance to Sixers fans who are hoping for either one. But what do you like about those two guys?
I mean, man, I had a chance to watch Mann in a private workout in Chicago. And the ball comes off his fingertips so easily. And he was just hitting logo three after logo three. And 6'5" with this effortless shooting range and off the dribble shooting range, which is so valuable in today's league. Like, that's what I really value with him. He's very creative off the dribble. He can stop and pop from anywhere. He's got one of the best floaters in the draft. And that's what I really like about him. The big question with Mann is, can he be a guy who runs your offense? Can he be a lead guard who makes decisions for your half-court offense? I'm not so sure. Like, one scout said to me, like, is he better than Anfernee Simons? And I'm like, I don't know. But I guess is that the type of player that he's going to be? I think Mann offers a little more playmaking ability. He's one of the best pick-and-roll players in the country this year, per synergy. And I think he's got some extra playmaking, but his value in the NBA is going to be his streak scoring ability. And the ability to get his own shot, connect from anywhere off the dribble. But I like him more, right, as a guy in the 20s, and not somebody you think of as being the guy who runs your offense. Although I think if you are thinking that, you're thinking more that he's going to be like a Darius Garland type would be the comparison I'd use. And then Trey Murphy, from what I'm hearing, scouts are thinking he's going top 20. He's one of those guys who's just, the momentum just keeps going. He's gaining a lot of steam. Really great kid who's only helping himself during these interviews. I think he's going to get overdrafted a little bit, but I also think he's a guy who's going to last 15 years in the league and play a key role, you know, as a supporting guy on playoff teams. He's 6'9", he's 43% from downtown, he's 92% from the free throw line. Like, there are just no questions that his shot's going to translate. And at that size, he's very mobile defensively. Not like a shot blocker or a big defensive stats guy, but he moves his feet very well. He's going to guard wings. In fact, I think he could play him at small forward. Is going to be his position. And just an easy fit and a great teammate. But he really gives you nothing off the dribble unless it's a straight line drive past the closeout. So I think for the right team, like, you know, a playoff team that needs his specific type of that specific type of player, then he's an easy fit. But I think there's a little he's going to go before guys who offer a little more upside.
Interesting. Okay. And then last question I have for you, you were in the in Chicago for the combine. Who are some of the names that were really, you know, helped themselves last week? Like, I saw Bones Highland in particular was really buzzing coming out of the combine, but who drew scouts' attention, or which guys were lower on boards and now scouts are going back and thinking like, oh, we might need to give this guy a second look.
Yeah, I mean, quickly on Highland, like Bones is known for his streak scoring. And I remember I was sitting with Ricky O'Donnell from SB Nation, and I was saying, like, if Bones comes out and just, like, catches fire and takes over the game, which is, like, he's the type of guy that can do this, he's going to move. And literally 15 minutes later, he had 15 points in, like, 10 minutes. He did exactly that and then shut it down. Yeah. But people see another quickly type, a Lou Williams type. Sounds like he's going first round. Everyone thinks he's going to be a first rounder. Josh Primo from Alabama is some guy who averaged 8 points a game this year. Was like basically just a spot up shooter all season, but he's the youngest player in the draft. He measured around 6'6". And in the scrimmages, we got to see some creation and off the dribble play that Alabama didn't give him the freedom to do. And when you combine his foundation as a 6'6", 39% shooter, the youngest player in the draft, and the room he has to improve off the dribble, somebody's going to take a chance probably in the late 20 range as just the project type guy. Guys who improved their stock, Josh Christopher from Arizona State. I would have guessed he would have not suited up for scrimmages. He's one of those five-star recruits. You think in terms of ego, like he deserved to be in that group of guys who sat out because they're too good for this stuff. But he played, which impressed a lot of scouts just by suiting up. And then not only did he suit up, but he played well. And he really showcased his explosiveness in the open floor, and he didn't make shots, but he was still productive and he still played hard, and he was loud and energetic and just it was very likable to watch out there. And if his shot ever improves and which it has the chance to do, he's another three level scorer, mid range guy who last seven games of the season shot over 40% from three. Like, he is a Jordan Clarkson type of guy. You're probably just not going to get results for a couple of years with him, but he certainly put himself in the first round picture. And Quentin Grimes is the last guy I'll touch on. Grimes was a McDonald's All-American a couple of years ago, went to Kansas, didn't really have any core skill. Like, his calling card was versatility, but you didn't really know what his bankable skill was. Transferred to Houston, became a knockdown shooter, played in these scrimmages, and not only was he ridiculous shooting, but he totally controlled the game, made good decisions, just tore apart the opposing defenses in both scrimmages. His game, he just screamed pro. And I think some team in the late 20s or early 30s, who is a playoff team, is going to be like, get this guy on my roster. He can help me next year.
Nice. Well, that is all the questions I have for you. Mort, any final things before we let Wes go?
Just two guys I have to ask about. First and foremost, Filip Petrušev, who played for Gonzaga previously, went to Serbia, played this year. Obviously, the numbers are pretty great. I mean, the 21 plus points, shot 46% from downtown, 56% overall. Like, he just seems, you just use the term, like, just scream pro. That's the same feeling I get when I watch this guy. Why is he slotted that low? What are the main issues? What are we all missing with him?
Yeah, I could be wrong. I mean, I could have him too low, and I've thought about it a lot. I just haven't heard much. And some of the guys' numbers in that league can be inflated sometimes.
Right.
But, he looks like a different guy than what we saw at Gonzaga. And obviously adding the jump shot has put him on the draft radar. Right. I mean, he was good at Gonzaga. But now he has a shot, and now we're talking about a draft pick. Like, if somebody took him in the late 20s, like, I wouldn't be totally shocked. I just haven't heard a ton of buzz about how believable everything he did in Serbia really was. But, yeah, he's a guy who's probably being slept on, including by me.
Interesting. And then the last one, this is courtesy of our former co-host, Sarah Chilea, because she is hitting me up on the DMs all the time asking me about Jeremiah Robinson Earl. I figured you'd be the perfect guy to just give us a proper JRE breakdown.
All right. Actually, I'll just repeat what a scout said to me. And he said, he goes, if I'm looking for just a pro who's going to last the next 10 years, and I'm okay with that, then I'll take Robinson Earl in the late first round. It's tough to envision any upside with him, but it's very easy to just see a pro whose job is to pick and pop, offensive rebounds, make good decisions, and capitalize on post position. I'm higher on him the most. In fact, when he came out of high school, he was top 10 on my board. I've always liked him. Obviously, that was too high, and I give him a late first round grade, even though I slot him at 41 in my latest mock draft, just because people don't really see any upside with him. But I think his game is very defined and structured, and he has an easy role in the NBA, and I think he's smart enough to know his limitations and play that role. And so I think some team is going to get away with a long-term role player, and they're probably going to get him in the second round.
Interesting. So he's a guy you might like. Is he going to be a spot time starter, a full time bench guy? Like, what is your projection here?
Yeah, it depends on where he goes, and maybe 5 years from now, he goes to a second team, and he has more opportunity. But I buy his shot. I mean, I know he didn't shoot great from downtown this year, but he was 50% in the mid range, and just looking at him shoot the ball, like, there's no reason to think that he can't take that mid range shot and step back a couple feet and eventually become a spot up pick and pop guy. And he's got a good body, and he, I thought he improved his quickness and explosiveness this year, like attacking closeouts. Like, he just looked a little more spry, which was, you know, he's not an explosive guy, so that was good to see. And so, yeah, to me, I just think he's just a very refined, fundamentally sound player who's going to find a way to stick.
Your description makes me think that he could be a lesser version of a Paul Millsap.
Yeah, a lesser version. Let me think of a guy like, yeah, or maybe like one of the Morris twins, like that type of guy. I don't know how he's going to be defensively. I'm still kind of torn on where I see him, if he's going to be a liability, if he's going to be, you know, good enough to play 20 plus minutes. But that type of value to a team where he's right, just a good, you know, maybe eighth guy.
Interesting. So a Morai twin, but without the necessary issues that follows, maybe.
Correct. No intangible issues there.
Good. Well, Wes, thank you as always for joining us today. This was awesome. I hope everyone, I know the draft is still a couple weeks away, but I hope this is a good primer for you to get into that mindset as well. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
NBA Draft Wes, Bleacher Report. And we'll continue to pump out content until July 29th. And then I'm sure on July 30th, we'll have a mock draft for 2022. Because that's what
sounds
we do.
Right. Yeah. And then hopefully you get a couple weeks off, because I'm sure this has been a marathon, like, you know, having the draft pushed so late last year and going right into the college season. I'm sure this has been a marathon year for you. So yeah. Kudos to all the hard work you've been doing. You've been killing it as always. And please follow Wes on Twitter. Check out his work at BR. I'm sure between now and draft night, you'll have at least 15 new mock drafts, because as you said, that's what we do. So thank you all, as always, for joining us today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles there in bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, today by Morten Jensen and by our special guest, Jonathan Wasserman. Have a good one, guys.
You too, man.